Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
From KQED.
I know. I'm like, look, mom's on TV. They're like, yeah. Like, who cares? Now, if I was playing soccer, they would be impressed. Hey, everybody. From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. Today on The Breakdown, the votes are still being counted, but this week's primary is shaping up to be a low turnout election. And, of course, who votes and who doesn't vote has big implications.
We're still waiting to see if Governor Gavin Newsom can get his mental health housing bond across the finish line. It's been barely hovering above the 50% mark. And there are a few congressional primaries that haven't been called yet. So what does this all mean for both Democrats and Republicans as we look at Tuesday's result and ahead to the November presidential election? In a minute, we'll be joined by Paul Mitchell. He's vice president at Political Data, Inc. They collect political data and use it to help Democratic campaigns. We'll sell it to them, actually. But first, Scott, a few updates on this week's results, which are still trickling in. As I said, Prop 1, still too close to call, 50.3% to 49.7%. That's about a 32,000 vote gap.
Yeah. Which sounds like a lot in some worlds that might be a lot, but not when you've got this many ballots still to count.
So we'll come back to that a little later, but a couple congressional races we've been watching as well. District 22 in the Central Valley, it does look like it's still shaping up to be a rematch between sitting Congressman Republican David Valadao and former Democratic Assemblyman Rudy Salas. And then down in the 49th District in Irvine, GOP's Scott Baugh will be facing State Senator Dave Minn. I don't even think the AP's called this, but Joanna Weiss did concede yesterday and endorsed Dave Minn, which
no
was
small
a little
matter.
Surprising.
Yeah, it was a very bitter election. They both ran really tough ads against each other, seemed very personal, very nasty. You know, Minn was going after Weiss's husband and how he made his money, defending the Catholic Church. And of course, Joanna Weiss focusing on Dave Minn's DUI arrest and all that. But they buried the hatchet pretty fast. I mean, it's rare, I think, as we've seen in other races, you know, Nikki Haley dropping out this week, not endorsing Donald Trump. And, you know, you can't blame her. And I wouldn't have blamed Joanna Weiss for taking a few days, you know,
right,
to wait.
But I think that that is what the parties expect, what a lot of voters like to see. And it is in stark contrast to what we're seeing in this U.S. Senate race between, ultimately, Adam Schiff and Steve Garvey will be facing off this fall. But Katie Porter, the third place person in that race, Democrat from Orange County, has not endorsed Schiff and is now getting a lot of heat for a couple of statements she made. First, she tweeted yesterday, thanked everybody supporting her campaign, and said, because of you, we had the establishment running scared, withstanding 3-1 in TV spending and an onslaught of billionaires spending millions to rig this election. She then doubled down today.
Operative word there being rigged.
Right. You might have heard that from another politician a few times recently.
Donald Trump.
And so today she put out a statement saying rigged means manipulated by dishonest means, and going on to say that a few billionaires spending $10 million on attack ads is, you know, rigging the system. And she's just getting a lot of pushback because of how much we have seen really Trump successfully undercut, you know, voter confidence in our election system.
I think it is true, as we were talking about earlier, that she has used the word rigged to describe the economy and how it's rigged toward the wealthy. But, you know, I'm sure I would think she realized when she tweeted that out that it's also very, it's a hot button issue. It's a loaded word, especially for Democrats, you know, with Trump basically denying the election results. And, you know, that second statement she put out today where she's defining what rigged means. I mean, there's an old expression, if you're explaining, you're losing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a good look.
And I do think, I mean, look, again, like this is a linguistic sort of turn of phrase that we've heard Bernie Sanders use in the past, Elizabeth Warren talking about the economy, even the system, you know, the political system. And it does fit with how Porter has tried to frame herself as an outsider. But I think in a race where, you know, the campaigns alone spent over $66 million. And when you add in outside spending, this campaign approached $100 million. And the top two spenders, I mean, Adam Schiff far outpaced Katie Porter, but she raised and spent a lot of money.
Well, and when she ran for re-election in 2022, she outspent her opponent, Scott Baugh, by, I think, $28 million to $3 million. Now, she didn't raise it from corporations and so on, but, you know, money alone, spending a lot of money is not by definition mean it's a rigged election. Both all the campaigns, most of the campaigns, not so much Barbara Lee, but, you know, they had a lot of money and they spent it.
Yeah, and I do think that, again, you know, she ran as an outsider. Schiff got all of the sort of establishment endorsements. I think this does raise questions, though, about like what happens next for Porter. She had to give up her House seat to make this, you know, to take on this race. And she's certainly not endearing herself to anyone in the Democratic Party at this moment. And I just do wonder, you know, I think we've talked here about, will she want to run for governor, attorney general? Will she run for another office? Like, does this hurt that?
Yeah, and we've also talked about how, you know, she only got one of the congressional delegation from California, one member of Congress endorsed her. And she said, oh, that was because of longstanding relationships and, you know, Pelosi and loyalty to Schiff and all that. And there may be some truth to that, but then you also kind of wonder, well, maybe they didn't like the way she behaved or the way she dealt with them. I mean, it does, I think, raise questions about temperament. And I know a lot of people are going to push back on that. I understand that. But nonetheless, it is not a gracious way to end your campaign.
No, and it will be interesting to just keep an eye on this. Like, I assume eventually she will endorse Schiff, maybe? Or does she just stay out of it? I mean, I don't know. You know, he certainly doesn't need it to beat Steve Garvey in this state where Democrats outnumber Republicans 2-1. Yeah, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, and the whole thing about complaining about elevating Garvey, I mean, she did the same thing with Eric Early, you know, who is even more conservative, a MAGA Republican. So it's politics, you know, it's kind of the way it works.
And it's the part of politics people really dislike.
True.
So
true enough.
Worth noting. All right. We are going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk with Politica data guru Paul Mitchell. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos, here with Scott Schaefer. Today we are speaking with Paul Mitchell. He is vice president at Political Data, Inc. They collect political data and use it to help Democratic campaigns. Paul, welcome back to The Breakdown.
Hey there.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get into this election, explain to our listeners a little bit more about what your firm does. Like, how is this data used by campaigns and how do you get it?
Yeah, so we provide data and, you know, we've got thousands of clients around the state, everything from the statewide ballot measure and governor and even presidential campaigns, but none this election cycle. and, you know, all the way down to like water board, school board, municipal elections, you know, all kinds of stuff. And when campaigns are actually getting started, they know they need to reach voters. And there's kind of two ways to do that from a data perspective. One is to just like go to the county and try to get a file from the county and then try to massage that data, figure out how to make a walk sheet or how to.
And this
make
would be like, these people are Democrats, these people are Republicans, that kind
of
thing.
If they can. Yeah. Or it depends on what they can get from the county, too. Or they can come to a vendor like ours, and PDI has been around for over 35 years. We're really just a California company in terms of where we manage the data in California. We sometimes do some tools outside of California, but in California, we are the data and the tools. And so a campaign gets started, they come to us, we turn on an account online. In minutes, they can be flagging voters, creating walk sheets, creating phone lists, creating mail lists, doing texting, doing phoning right in the online system, doing emailing and all that stuff to their voters. And then we manage the data centrally. So we get the voter updates and they just get updated automatically in their accounts. And it's, campaigns in California are really lucky. I was a client of PDI's when I first started doing campaigns. In other parts of the country, we just don't have this kind of a thing, like a state-born company that just does this data work in California, right? you know, it's much better, higher level than what you get in other states around the country.
Yeah, well, one of the things that people like us sign up for is after the ballots go out, we sign up for a little notice that your company sends out on a daily basis to follow either the statewide return of ballots or individual congressional districts. And there's, you know, nice graphs with charts and lined, you know, graphs of all the information, who voted, what age group, and how that reflects the electorate versus
ethnicity,
all this stuff. And it's really amazing. And I'm wondering, like, is that information required in California? Do counties require that information? And is it that different? And if you tried to do this in Florida, for example, or Texas, what would happen?
I've actually done it in other states before. I've done a national one before, but in nationally, the voter data companies that we work with nationally, they don't like to just give out data for free. And they think it's kind of funny that we do this and just make it publicly available. We don't make any money selling this data to the public. We just make it available. All the campaigns can sign up for it, and they get daily updates for their election as to who's voted. People ask, like, how do you know who's voted? But the way that it works is that county registrars will provide just the voter IDs of everybody who's returned a ballot so that a campaign can remove those voters from their list and not waste money mailing them or phoning them or whatever. And for voters, there's this nice thing of like, hey, if I mail in my ballot, maybe the mailers will stop. And if they're using PDI data, then their mailers will stop and the text messages and everything stops.
But there's also the racial, ethnic data, the age.
Yeah, but so all we get is the IDs, but then we join that to our larger database. Mm-hmm. And our database is managed year round. And we know where people were born, if they get language ballots, if we know from data work we do what their kind of inferred, you know, ethnicity is. We know, you know, if they're Democrat or Republican, or if they used to be a Democrat or Republican, or they, you know, if they're ideologically conservative or liberal. We know all this stuff that we build year round. And all we do is we kind of append those to that data set, and we create a real nice infographic using Tableau, which is like a tool for kind of, you know, graphics that explain data. And, it really is well received. There's a lot of people who haven't been PDI clients, and the only way they know of PDI is like, oh, that data that I get.
Well, it's one of the reasons we have you here. Right. So let's talk about it. What did we see this year? Like, who came out? What do we know about turnout? Who voted? Who didn't?
Yeah. So what we know from the earliest vote. So let's say when we got to the point of election day and we were right at around 18% of the ballots had been received. We knew that we were already looking probably to have a low turnout election. The data showed that the electorate was old, white, and more conservative. And our kind of metric we were measuring against mostly was the 22 primary, the gubernatorial primary election, simply because that's the only other primary we've had in this state where everybody had been mailed a ballot. We could compare to the 16 or 20 presidential race, but, you know, in 16, there were only 17 million voters. There's 22 million now. And in 20, we were just, you know, the beginning stages of COVID and, you know, only some counties were mailing ballots to all their voters. So it wasn't a good apples to apples. But looking back at the 22 gubernatorial primary, gubernatorial primaries are usually the lowest turnout of all of our elections. And this election was coming in, you know, considerably more conservative, higher Republican turnout, lower Democratic turnout. The age stuff was incredible. There are equivalent numbers of seniors and voters aged 18 to 34. Both of those age groups have 5.5 million voters. But we were at a point early on where we had 1.2 million voters from seniors and 200,000 voters from those under the age of 35. That is crazy. It was this hall of mirrors effect where you go in and these two groups are the same size in the data, you come out the other end and one is six times larger than the other. And
I mean, there's always a gap there, right?
Yeah, older voters always are more likely to vote, right?
Yeah, but so what's funny is we see that this voting patterns, and we're watching now the people whose ballots are being registered now as having been received. So we're now still getting data. Mm. We're not sending out the tracker, but I have data from the last 2 days. And I was looking as an example at Fresno County and San Diego County. In Fresno County, the population that was seniors in the early voting was 58% of the votes that came in. And now the last 2 days of ballots that came in, meaning those that were, you know, dropped off or mailed late.
The procrastinators, yes.
Only 38% are seniors. So that dropped by 20 points.
Wow.
And it used to be the other, I mean, it's changed, right? I mean, I remember, first of all, when I first started voting in California, in order to vote by mail at all, they called it absentee voting. You had to kind of have an excuse. And I think you had to ask for it every, so now that anybody can vote all the time by mail, what has that done to the calculation and the, you know, the ability to sort of project what the votes are going to be like on election day versus the ones that have arrived before then?
Yeah. So there's two real important points here. One is our voting now has a when component. If you think about politics and I'm going to campaign for Congress, you think about these ways to break up the electorate, the partisanship of the voters, the ages of the voters, the ethnicity of the voters. And now there's the when of the voters, because campaigns can now look and see that these people always vote late and these people always vote early. And then when you're watching the votes come in California, traditionally, the early vote was always really old because you had to request an absentee ballot. And counties, if you didn't vote, would take you off of the list of people getting absentees because they thought, why waste the money on postage if they're not going to vote? And then the late vote would be, you know, younger, more Democratic. We have now this additional thing where not only now are everybody getting ballots, so these are kind of exacerbated, these trends, but also now you have this one pocket since 2020 of conservative Republicans who are kind of the Trumpy Republicans who want to only vote in person. And they either vote in person by walking in their ballot or by going to a machine. And so we see these disparities now, especially in conservative counties, where the late vote will be younger. But then there's also this other stream of like really Republican rich Republican vein of voters. And then in a county like, I was just looking at San Diego County. In San Diego County, the late voters, you know, the early voters were 53% seniors. Now they're 29% seniors. But in partisanship, they were 35% Republican. And now they're still 35% Republican. So the voters that are coming in are younger and they're
more conservative.
They're not as well. In Fresno County, the Republican numbers go way up with late ballots.
Okay, so it's not as much. So that makes it harder for us all to do our like, okay, well, there's this many votes out there and that could mean X for this. But let me ask you, since you have a better, you know, bird's eye view of this, Prop 1, if you're Newsom right now, are you like sweating in your office every minute, like refreshing?
Potentially. But
how does it look like? Do you, I mean, I like, obviously you probably don't want to make a prediction.
Newsom's campaign for Prop 1 really is kind of, I think, waiting now until we find out how many ballots are outstanding in each of the counties. And in a county like Fresno County, where we're seeing the late vote skew even more Republican, they're concerned about how many ballots that are there versus a county like LA County where the late votes might skew more Democratic and even more Democratic maybe than on election day. And then there's also cross currents like Fresno County, the vote might be more Republican, but it's also a lot younger. So how does that fare on their ballot measure? So they're definitely going to be watching it. People might have some spreadsheets and trying to figure it out. But in the end, my gut is that it kind of washes out a little bit. The conservative counties, the Placer counties kind of wash out the more Democratic counties on the coast, and that essentially we end up where we left off with that ballot measure, with narrowly passing.
I know you're a data guy, but you know, there's a lot of theories as to why the turnout is high or low. In this case, you know, a lot of people think, well, there wasn't a lot of excitement at the top of the race, at the top of the ticket, you know, with Biden and Trump being foregone conclusions. But on the other hand, you know, we had a kind of a lively Senate race, I guess, and there were two progressive women who were very much supported by younger voters and voters of color, but they seem to have not turned out as much. Like, what accounts for that, do you think?
So when we look at elections, there's always two components to turnout. The first is mechanical. How do you register to vote? How do you stay registered? How do you get a ballot? How do you return your ballot? And when you return your ballot, will it be counted? And California's pushed all those up to 11. I mean, that is, you know, we are kind of a benchmark for the country. The other is kind of the enthusiasm. And enthusiasm is kind of the, you know, am I seeing this in my popular culture? You know, when it's a presidential general, you could be on Instagram or anything and you're going to see stuff about the election.
Right. This one, you that, like walked down the street and it was like, is there an election happening?
That feeling of like, you know, this is maybe the most important election of my lifetime. Like that was taken out of this election because we didn't have a presidential primary on the Democratic or Republican side. And a real good parallel to this election was the 2012 primary, when Obama was running for re-election and there was no Democratic primary and the Republican primary had been ended because Romney had already won the primary before our June primary. So 31% turnout in that election, we might end up being 31% turnout in this election. The one key thing that's important for people to understand is that this doesn't mean low turnout in November. You know, the 2012 general was high turnout, and we would expect that by November, everybody's going to be waking up thinking, you know, this is either the worst or most important election of my lifetime. But either way, they're going to probably end up turning out and voting.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio. I'm Marisa Lagos, here with Scott Schaefer. Our guest today, political data expert Paul Mitchell. Well, we promised folks we would look ahead a little bit, and I want to kind of ask you about something related both to this week and potentially the fall, which is Gaza and the war between Hamas and Israel in Gaza. We saw in several other states, you know, movements for folks to vote uncommitted in places where that was an option. A few days before Tuesday, progressives here started saying write-in ceasefire, you know, as a write-in candidate. I know you've talked about the fact that there's not really a good way to count that. Do we know anything about whether there was an undervote in the Democratic? I mean, Biden's at like 89% right now. It's not a, it wouldn't be a huge one. But what do you know about that movement and if it had any effect here?
Well, first off, from the purely the data perspective, if you were to ask me what's the undervote on the Republican primary,
just say what undervote means. Just explain that. Explain what an undervote is.
So I can tell you how many people skipped voting in the Republican primary or did a write-in that was for a non-qualified candidate relative to how many Republicans voted because they have a closed primary. And I know what the denominator is, right? I know how many people got the Republican ballot. For Democrats, you get a Democratic ballot if you are a Democrat or if you request a Democratic ballot. And in 2020, we did a great job of going to every county and saying, who requested a Democratic ballot? Who requested a Democratic ballot? And we were really focused on getting that data because the campaigns needed to know who is eligible to vote for the Democratic presidential race.
Because there were like 65 people in that race.
Yeah. And we had like 800,000 people request a Democratic ballot. In this election cycle, we got 129,000 people requesting a Democratic ballot, and that was only from some counties that gave it to us. So the point is that we don't right now have the data on even how many people had Democratic ballots because there was no incentive for us to go chasing this data down from the counties. So that lack of knowing what the denominator is means that we can't really tell you what percentage of undervote we had clearly. And so that protest probably won't ever be quantified by anyone because I don't think anybody's going to go through the trouble of going to all 58 counties and trying to identify exactly how many ballot requests they got for the Democratic ticket.
What are your thoughts about, you know, what other states do, which is to offer that option that says either not committed to anyone or, you know, basically none of the above? Nevada does that. Michigan does that. Is that a good idea, a bad idea? I mean, would it bring more people out maybe?
I remember this being an issue, none of the above, when I was in college in the 90s. I don't have any opposition to that. One thing I do think we should have in terms of a more effective voting system for our presidential primaries is one that's like the other primaries we see, which is essentially all the candidates from all the parties are on the same ticket. And if the Democratic Party, the Republican Party want to say, okay, then we're not going to count your primary, then challenge you, go for it. Don't count the biggest state with the most delegates. But the reality is that voters would be much better off if we had the same system rather than this goofy thing where independents who want to vote for the Republican primary have to re-register, go through those hoops, and Democrats, independents who are leaning Democratic have to request a ballot. It's a paperwork mess. It doesn't really empower voters and it doesn't help turnout.
So for folks who maybe did that, wrote in ceasefire or are disaffected and mad at the Democrats over what's happening, there's not really any way to quantify what happened.
There's not a way to quantify. They can, you know, take a picture of it. Now there's a state law that was passed that allows you to take a picture of your ballot, believe it or not, which used to be illegal. You can take a picture of it and you can tweet that. And that can be, you know,
we can count them on Twitter.
Yeah, you can, and then we can count all the hashtag tweets. But no, unfortunately, that's a form of a protest that will not be truly quantifiable in the data that we have.
What do you make of the fact that in the months leading up to this election, the Republicans made some strides in registration? Yeah. You know, for every few months before the election, the Secretary of State kind of releases this voter registration data. And Republicans were quite happy with the fact that they actually gained ground against Democrats and no party preference, which had not happened for a long time. They've been bleeding voters for decades.
Yeah. So I saw this and I dove into it and I did some tweets on this. The fact is that there was a period of time in, late November, December, going into January, where Republican registration spiked. And I actually went in and looked at all the different registration methods. There's like 20 different methods of registering to vote, whether you use a paper form or you're part of an organized signature form, you know, organized effort, or you did it at a library or you did it at a registrar. If you did it at the DMV, all those things are methods. And we actually identified the method of registration for this big registration spike for Republicans was people registering to vote online. And we can actually look at the days in which it peaked. And so there's two theories right now. One is that the GOP did a big, you know, digital campaign to try to get independents that used to vote Republican to re-register Republican. The other is that counties actually mailed out these postcards to voters that said, if you want to get a Democratic ballot for independents. If you want to get a Democratic ballot, you need to request it by this date. If you want to get a Republican ballot, you need to re-register Republican. And here's the link to register to online. And that's what drove that Republican bump. The important thing is that this probably doesn't mean a sign of more votes for Republicans in future elections. This probably is a re-registration of people who maybe thought they were Republicans, but were actually independents, or were independents that vote Republican regularly, you know?
Or what about ones who re-registered to vote against Trump?
Yeah. I plan on doing a poll of every voter that re-registered in those 2 months as Republican online and ask them what got them to do that and if they're going to re-register independent or something like that. So try to unpack that. It's a really interesting thing.
Is there anything just in there that we saw like way more in specific congressional districts or anywhere where that could be an issue in the fall for either side? Yeah.
I looked at that too, and I looked to see whether or not there was a spike in those competitive congressional districts, and it looked like it was a little bit higher, like in those Central Valley districts that So that made me think it was more of an organized effort. But again, I plan on doing some polling to unpack it and figure it out, just to, for all of us who are wondering what that is, to better understand it. The one thing that we didn't talk about, which I've been talking about a lot, which I think is fun, is how the elevation of Garvey in that Senate race ended up elevating Republicans in a lot of districts.
Oh, interesting. When you say elevation, do you mean by Schiff, or what do you mean?
Yeah. So Schiff spent all this money promoting Garvey, more money spent on a Republican statewide than ever before since Meg Whitman, you know. But you look like just a perfect microcosm of this. And I want to try to do like a little family tree diagram of this. He elevates Schiff, spends all this money on Republicans. His congressional seat, it was supposed to be like Ben Seinfeld, Anthony Porentino, Laura Friedman, and this Bilekian guy.
Right.
Got second place in his congressional race. The Republican got the second spot. So depriving us of a Dem-on-Dem race, depriving Portantino of an opportunity.
But there's also like 20% Armenians in that district.
Yeah, I know. I did that data that, yeah, the turnout of Armenians was really high. But it probably, if we do the math, probably even if you took out the Republican-leaning Armenians, it should be. But then Portantino and Friedman, both of their districts, in Friedman's district, the Republicans in first place. In Portantino's district, the Republicans in second place, ahead of Yvonne Yu, that woman who ran for controller, who spent a ton of money on this race. So there's this, the Cabaldon race, the Republicans in first place. The Maggie Krell in Sacramento race, the Republicans in second place. Like, all over the state, we have all these closed out elections that we were expecting Dem on Dem races.
Well, thanks, Adam Schiff, say the Dems. That is Paul Mitchell of Political Data Inc. Thank you, as always, for your insight tonight and
for all the number crunching.
This week. Yeah.
Thanks.
That is going to do it for this edition of Political Breakdown. We're a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our engineer today is Jim Bennett. Our producers are Guy Marzorati and Izzy Bloom. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. For more election results and everything else, check out kqed.org. And we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.